I never got to see him. That must have been extraordinary.
Now, I think...
Was that from high school reunion? I guess it was his own
back that high school reunion.
Yeah. I guess my just
It's amazing how much energy the guy has. No matter how old he gets, he doesn't
have to shift it.
Thank you.
1-4, conduct a 3-to-5-year randomized controlled trial to compare copaxone, fingolimod, thymidine, interferon, peg interferon, and sensory and everything. So we talked this morning, this goes back to question 1A and the straw person questions and had a lengthy debate about it. Hi. In patients with relapsing MS, what is the impact of step therapy for medications on relapse rates, patient daily functions? So we talked about that. That's one of the things we may propose as our third question. Six, among MS patients receiving a disease-modifying therapy who experience a relapse, what are the benefits and risks of continuing same therapy versus switching? Blah, blah, blah. That's question 1 and 2. Seven, in people with a diagnosis of relapsing MS, what are the comparative benefits of the current disease-modifying therapies on disability progression, cognitive function, depression, and quality of life? Well, that would also encompass in question 1A.
I think depression comes up here, though. We didn't talk a lot about depression in the, when we talked about 1A here. I mean, we talked about quality of life and other measures, but depression is potentially important.
As a measure, one of the measures along with cognitive functions is fatigue. That is an important outcome measure. Question one, consideration. In my mind, cognition and depression.
Actually, cognitive cognition we didn't talk about, but to your point, we talked about it briefly earlier.
The cognition and depression is other important.
And fatigue. Those are all things that probably should be individually capturing, not simply in a general quality.
And I apologize. I want to introduce Dr. Lila Labatani, who's here. This is Dr. for Kim Daly, who had to leave because of family illness of her daughter. Thank you, Lila.
Thank you for taking over.
1.7 and 1.1, they're kind of similar, and I think the idea is just to make sure to go beyond our traditional endpoints and incorporate the disease. So I think that is just a holistic view of the disease.
Moving into the Tysabri questions. In patients with MS on Tysabri, is there efficacy by clinical relapse disability progression MRI to the safety of extended dosing of nadolizumab? Or what are the comparative benefits and risks of extended versus FDA-approved dosing? So I presume the author of that question is referring to giving the drug every 2 months or something else. I think this is probably a question that would require lots of patients. It would be a comparative effectiveness question, but doesn't get me very excited.
But is there, I actually went and checked the FDA dosing, and it certainly is showing the change in the risk of PML with longer duration, exhortations that, the rate is not known for periods of time beyond a certain number of years. Is there a time period now where most clinicians are
saying I don't think that's what they mean by the question. I think they mean by, other people interpret it the way I interpret it, which is, the dose is currently given once every 28 days. The drug probably works definitely works for longer than that. Mike is an expert here, so he can address that. But, so there are centers that are giving the drug every 2 weeks or every 2 months or every 6 weeks in with the idea that maybe the fewer infusions over a long period of time may diminish the risk of recurrence.
That's probably what they're asking.
So, given the low frequency of PML, even other patients, it seems to me it would take an enormous number of patients for a lot of years to try to answer that question. It's not very practical. Same as the next question. 110. Persons with relapsing remitting MS study the comparative effectiveness of currently approved therapies on MS symptoms.
Should we add specificity to the outcomes for question one?
I wouldn't add specificity, frankly, in part because the scales for measuring it are currently so bad.
Any other comments?
Along the same line, should we be thinking about patient satisfaction as one of the measures in the study?
differ with you, Aaron, but because we may not currently have a good measure of specificity, it's obviously an issue for people with MS, so maybe it's, you know, worthy of inclusion just so that can be considered in design.
And I think pain is reasonable also. Another one that was underappreciated.
Symptoms. So those are symptoms.
Capture.
So we're adding those to the other
questions.
And I think what you could do is you could just find the symptoms that are most problematic for patients in any stage of the disease and just make sure that if there's not a good measure, we consider developing one. If there is good measure, consider incorporating
there should be
it.
There should be captured also bladder function. It's fatigue, walking, and bladder dysfunction that are the three components that most impair quality of life. Probably adding cognitive to that.
Once diagnosed with MS and genotyped, how should the patient be treated to help them return to normal or to be as functional as possible? That falls into the too vague to consider category.
Yeah, I think it rolls up in maybe to the quality of life and how they end it. They end it with quality of life, so maybe that's how their way of just saying general sense of well-being.
Right. I mean, some may have overlap. You know, these are trying as much as possible to reflect the questions that came to us. We also have another group that's looking at symptomatic treatment of MS, you know, outside of disease-modifying therapies. They're looking at, you know, antidepressants and their, you know, use in the depression associated with MS. So that's a little out of scope for us.
I do see one thing in this question that shows something similar for the MS research program, and that is, and maybe it's not appropriate here, but what's the treatment plan for, you know, if you're diagnosed, you get on a DMT, then how are you monitored after that? Are you monitored for, what I wanted to see to answer questions about just the future, I guess the uncertainty of living with MS, is to set a standard of care, patient care, in the clinic.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you have a symptom of relapse or whatever, you know, this doctor, that doctor, or do you see the neurologist, you know, how often do you get MRI? And maybe this question really isn't saying that, but that's kind of how I semi-interpreted it a little bit.
You're not constrained to what they thought, but you're allowed to enhance it.
But remember, the question that would need to be addressed has to be able to compare two options, or more than two options.
Right.
So you have to have
but if you think about,
for comparison for PCORI to be interested.
I mean, maybe it belongs in the care section that's down the hall, but it's the idea of, you know, there are quality measures being potentially advanced that would standardize perhaps monitoring practice. So what's the benefit of that compared to not? One question that could be asked is that DMT plus what exalts different outcomes? So is it DMT plus monitoring, you know, or DMT plus other, you know, continuing comprehensive care or something like that? I mean, I think that those
social
are...
social work and psychology or whatever. Yeah. Is access.
So is it access to a team versus not? So I think those are... And I don't know if they might be talking about it on the... it's a great idea,
But if there is variability and uncertainty about the frequency with which, say, for instance, MRI should be done in patients, that I think gets at the primary comparative effectiveness of MRI for monitoring disease activity. And maybe that's a good parking lot question that we don't have it. What compares effectiveness of following MRIs every 6 months, every year, in terms of monitoring disease progression and achieving better control?
That could be,
If you are, I just thought of this, but if you are on a DMT and it's any of the interferons, for example, you know, how, maybe if nothing else, charting the point at which patients do or do not wind up with liver issues, for example, side effects. Known side effects from some of the drugs. And I just use that one because I'm familiar with it. But I don't know what some of the others may be. So And again, I don't know if that's would be appropriate for this group or as a parking lot. Is that what you call it, parking lot question?
Would you consider it a harm? The first question had benefits and harm.
And harm.
So I think that
progression of liver disease or liver harm should be
measured.
Yeah,
whether it would
be
any toxicity. But getting back to this question of the frequency of MRI, of course, how often you monitor MRIs doesn't have any influence on the disease course. How it influences the behavior of the neurologist. So if we're going to ask that question, you have to tie that.
The question would be, would monitoring enhance outcomes? Because it gives, you know, if there is an opportunity, potentially the hypothesis could be any opportunity for monitoring would be an opportunity for improved care. But you'd have to translate that to, does that derive outcomes?
So it's kind of another way of asking the question of a threshold that gets you to change. Are you better off switching?
Right.
So what monitoring more frequently would do, presumably, would get people to make switches earlier.
Right.
Would MRI monitoring contribute in any way to brain, I'm using this word, I don't know if it's the right word, but like atrophy, things like that. I mean, I know you're looking for specific disease activity, but you would look for other kinds of things related to cognitive issues, I would think.
Good
point. So, throwing it out there. If it's not appropriate, that's fine, but I just...
And I think it ultimately gets at the issue, to what extent might you modify your treatment approach based upon MRI findings? And I think, given that there's probably a fair amount of variability of what findings precipitate a change in therapy, I think it might be complex to untangle. But, you know, if someone's fighting to get an MRI every 2 years versus, you know, a center such as yours does, probably how often? I think it may or may not be a question. Anyway, I don't want to be realist.
It's not in here, and maybe there's not a question there at all, but let me just throw out, with Copaxone coming off patent, and there being generics and biosimilars kind of out there, is there something we should be asking ourselves for the DMC room, something we should be asking ourselves about comparison between, or is that just all an FDA's bailiwick?
You mean whether or not...
Comparison between Copaxone and biosimilars or something like that, is there some future study on the horizon about whether or not...
Should there be?
I don't know.
I'm going to refer that one to John. I would say that's generally an FDA value to determine whether or not it approves the drug as being...
Well, clearly, approving is up to FDA, but I didn't know if it was anything for us to study, but maybe not.
I think the question would be less about approval, but more utilization by the physician... clinicians, because that's where the question around, say, Copaxone or even another biosimilar is really going to come into play. At least that's what I'm hearing. But I'm not a neurologist, so I'll let the neurologist speak to it. But I think that's the sort of sense of, like, well, you know, is it this versus, and I think that's the concern that I hear. But I'm not sure that there's a CER study in that. At this point, that might be more of a clinical study.
Well, but does the likely availability of generic Copaxone make the feasibility of comparison initial treatment with Copaxone versus, you know, the conventional initiation of interferon more feasible, like we were talking about before?
Probably not appreciably. I would think if we do a study where you're on any agent of generic Copaxone.
There actually is already a study that's been done on it anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Let's go through these questions about subgroups as well. So, question 12, compare intensity of primary progressive symptoms and comorbidities across ethnic and socioeconomic groups before and after effective treatment of the comorbidity.
the comorbidity is a very important term. I just was at an international workshop last weekend, jointly sponsored by the MS Society and Ectrum, on comorbidity. It's a very poorly understood area of MS that clearly needs more work, but this is a fuzzy kind of question. The definition of effective treatment of the comorbidity is going to be very hard to define.
Well, let me push a bit on this and invite the group as well. In treating patients who present with MS at any stage of their disease, if they have some other comorbid condition and some of the things that have, if they have underlying blood dysphagia or some kind of hepatic disease, does that influence your choice of therapy?
Yes, it certainly does. But those kinds of things are very rare. What are common comorbidities are psychiatric comorbidities, depression and anxiety, and cardiovascular comorbidities, just common ailments. Those are by far the main comorbidities that would potentially affect the clinical decision. That's not the question he's asking here. Really asking what is the impact of that comorbidity specifically on the disease. Matter of patients MS do worse if the comorbidity is not managed.
So have those patients with comorbidities been excluded from the usual?
Yes.
So there isn't much data out there.
So I had the privilege of also leading a breakout group at that conference, and that was, one of the issues talked about was how do we do studies and we include people with these comorbidities, because in the real world, we don't say you can't be treated because you have heart disease or because you have a history of depression. So we have to make those decisions, but there's no randomized controlled trial data on those patients. For most of those comorbidities, they're automatically excluded from
studies, and that's where observational studies and epidemiological help. Because you can't do that in a trial because you want to. It makes it hard to interpret your results, but in some sort of observational cohort study, you can do that, and you can also use those data tied into epidemiological data using all the various things that all the tools that you guys have to do that. So that's very amenable to observational studies.
But
risks are always going.
But if patients are steered away from these drugs, if they have the comorbidities, it seems you're actually, is there merit to say among individuals with comorbidities such as, pre-existing depression, cardiovascular disease, what is the best comparative effectiveness of treatment, A versus C versus C, whatever? Would that be a benefit?
It would be a benefit to know that, but you slice the pie very thin with make a requirement for the particular comorbidity.
But as you stated, those are pretty common ones.
The psychiatric ones are probably up in the 20-30% range prevalent at any given point in time. And the others, heart disease may be down at 10%. 5-10%. Smokers.
Smoking is probably the most significant one.
That is a subgroup that could definitely, because there's a lot of evidence that smoking worsens the course of MS in addition to increasing the risk of getting MS, and that's probably a common enough comorbidity, if you will, or lifestyle thing that you could have, that you could look separately at smokers versus non-smokers in terms of a response to medical care.
But there's this element of socioeconomic status worked in here too. Is there anything that we need to do to sort of address that?
I'm wondering if that would be something to tease out, because at the lunch we were having a conversation about access issues that individuals, particularly who are on Medicaid, have around MS therapy, and there being some states where your only choice is Copaxone, that's it.
Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah.
You know, and that, it seems to me, that's a very clear, you know, socioeconomic impact that could be examined in the comparative.
I do think it's, I mean, as much as it's disparity of income, it's disparity of access, which is, you know, I mean, I think that we know that patients who don't have access to MS specialists fare differently. Patients, we don't know yet if, you know, if there's a difference between if you have access to a multidisciplinary team. We don't know if that improves your outcomes, but it's, you know, I think it is related to, I mean, we believe it does, but there's not a lot of evidence.
Yeah. Even timeliness of diagnosis.
Absolutely.
Certainly it links to outcome. And then if you say that it's harder to get diagnosed if you're of lesser socioeconomic status, then hence if you add those effects.
Yeah, well, I think that of all the subgroups, socioeconomic status is probably the most important one to look at because
it's just one thought, and that is, you're talking about primary progressive, but something that I've been talking to people that I know who are primary progressive, and not so much the comorbidities, but the symptoms, and the fact that most people who are primary progressive do not move. They're wheelchair bound or they cannot walk normally and regularly. And therefore, most of them experience more things like bladder issues, with the urinary tract infection, male infant, things like that. And it's mainly because they're not able to get those organs positioned in a way and utilized in a way that if you can walk normally, sit and, you know, lie, et cetera. So just a thought in terms of, and I don't know how you do an effectiveness study on it, but it's the fact that they do bed sore, not, well, I guess the insular bed sore, I don't know what to call it, but from being seated all of the time, and I'm wondering if there's an increase in plasticity again because they don't move in. So I don't know if it fits, but I did want to concentrate as much on the comorbidities as much as the symptoms that, you know, after a time, primary progressive people suffer for. And over the 15 years that I've been involved in the MS community, the people that I know that, in my view, you know, were gone too soon are primary progressive and suffer. And the reason for their passing in the medical records or whatever is, you know, some related to MS or whatever, and not necessarily MS.
Well, there is another group, and I would invite you when we have the group discussion at the end to raise that issue, or because I think that if they haven't discussed it, it would be very important.
Okay. And I think the care for PPMS is incredibly important, but I think with our remit of being the DMT group, and there's not a DMT approved, that makes it hard.
There is no
but I do, I hope that that question is being served to the right group, for sure.
Part of the outcomes of lower socioeconomic groups, I mean, part of the problem in looking at a study of them is that many of them are not in the, they're not in the system. They don't get identified. Person, as soon as they're in the system, that's a little extra bias.
And I think we all acknowledge the merits of looking at these policy issues that have an influence on access. That's something that PCORI is enjoined from doing as part of our authorization. So it's not we're pointedly not going to be setting policy or guidelines from our work. So if there were a way to think of it.
But you wouldn't be enjoined from looking at whether patients in a defined lower socioeconomic status had a worse outcome than patients who were in the higher.
Well, I'm not sure what the comparative effectiveness question is that you're answering that makes a difference in clinical care. We could make everybody lower SES, higher SES.
Yeah,
we don't like to do that.
So you don't have an
interest. Well, but it's in your own institution.
It could be intervention.
You could look at a single, you know, set of drug and just see those who get you know, or based on socioeconomic status, whether it's, you know, the same drug in the two groups. I mean, you can see people. I think you could do something that sort of does compare, but I'm not saying it's easy, but it is, I don't know, it's an important question that nobody's looking at. So if there is a way...
I think it's important, but what would be the thing that would change clinical care?
I think it's a patient factor that could drive outcomes. I mean, we know with lots and lots of different chronic conditions that you are at low SDS, particularly in the United States, you're going to do more poorly, and maybe, you know, a different management strategy or, you know, but I do think it's more of, you know, amongst these other potential stratification factors or subgroup factors.
So is that something you're capturing, like, using gender and ethnicity and everything else? And
meaning clinically or like, as a covariate? Yeah.
Another thing you're capturing, like, you do gender and
Yeah. We should, probably.
And then
you can
stratify your results
based on that.
I mean, you probably should look at it as a covariate at the least.
You can do it different, too, probably.
Sure.
You probably figure out your
code
or profession.
But now you find out where people do worse, okay? And where do you go from there?
Right.
But unless you believe that there's some, you know, barrier to understanding because they're educationally disadvantaged or...
It might be that they need a different component in their care.
Yeah.
So the same argument that we made is, like, so you have this genetic polymorphism. What do you do? You can't change your genetic background.
Coming back
like,
to the smoking question. You
can do something about that. Yeah. I mean, I think at the least, maybe we should consider it as like an important patient-related factor that's under study.
I think it's completely fair to acknowledge. I'm just focusing on what we might ask the research community to address within Macquarie's sponsorship.
All right. The next question here was, what is the risk benefit of a given DMT for patients by degree of underlying disease? So here's the question of the particular drugs work better in patients with so-called more aggressive disease.
This was kind of related to one of the questions that our team had was, you know, I think that people who are MS specialists and, you know, people like you and your colleagues, like you have in your clinical repertoire the patient characteristics that probably are prognostically poor. But I just wonder, you know, is there a way to, through an evidence-based method, generate data that shows there's a profile of patient characteristics that could be easily determined through clinical care, that could be disseminated widely, that would perhaps help physicians make a decision early in disease. You know, because I think, like, your clinic, you guys probably have a sense of this patient looks like this. This might be a patient I would consider.
Right. I think one could easily define a profile.
Mm-hmm.
Says, okay, you're in the high-risk profile, and we want to treat you in a certain way. And then one could look at that, but you'd have to compare.
Like, do they get better? Yeah.
What's the comparison here? With a, you have to compare two or more agents in the highly aggressive profile. So again, go back to the same original question, although it might be easier to pick the agent.
Yeah.
For instance, you might want to look at starting one group by Tysabri or alemtuzumab very early on, as opposed to an orally.
So like the escalation question.
I'm back sort of for that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see if there's anything else quickly.
Yeah, these questions on subgroups may or may not be duplicative. I think we've already, from this group consensus, it sounds like those who smoke, maybe interventions related to smoking cessation in this population may have special merit. SDS is something that's important, though not clearly amenable to a ready intervention. And are there any other subgroups that we, in terms of, you know, we were just speaking about people with more severe, the minority of patients who have clearly more aggressive disease, who may merit two-drug therapy as opposed to single-drug therapy.
You have depression, anxiety, and heart disease also.
Okay, thanks.
The other subgroup that could be of interest are African Americans. There's suggestion that although they develop MS less frequently, their disease may be more severe on average
than Caucasians.
So again, when the question is that patient population, do they behave differently to the various disease modifying agents? Hard question to answer would require a very large.
Well, it is, because most of the studies have between 5% and 7% on African Americans included within the study. Very, very low numbers.
So, subgroup of interest, but study design very. All right, so I think we should go back and
we just had one question. I mean, just in terms of subpopulations and. I don't know, this is just something that occurred to me thinking about patient population. Has the question of, postpartum management of MS, do you think, been adequately addressed? Like, is this, just in terms of, do you delay breastfeeding? Do you start a therapy immediately? Because there's this lore that you get on board. There seems to be data that you get worse right after delivery and issues of when to breastfeed, when to stop. I don't know if there's anything in there.
We've actually funded a study. I don't know that it's reported out, but Annette Langer-Gould actually looking at that.
I know that's her interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she's actually specifically looking at that discontinuation issue.
Yeah, I'll answer your question or not. Most of them are sort of, they die.
Many of us allow Copaxone, but not everybody allows Copaxone, and pretty much nobody allows anything else.
Yeah, Copaxone doing category B. Close.
I know that she won't report probably for another year or so.
But is there a comparative effectiveness study around the treatment of pregnancy and the peripartum periods?
There's not, I would say, agreement. Most people give nothing except restoration of the disease modifying therapy if the patient is not, if the patient is not nursing. Depending on what drug is, some allow interferon, the Copaxone, nursing mothers. I can't. And there are some people that give IVIG postpartum based on a very poor Israeli study. All right, so back to square one.
We have two strong questions. I think I heard in our parking lot, we can go back and look at some of these. I think one that came from the source of the fine question, I think we're okay at the moment, Leila, has the issue of step therapy, which is one that perhaps can be a third question to add.
I think that's a reasonable third question.
Yeah, I agree.
And might we call it, what is the comparative effectiveness of the fee of initiating patients on step therapy?
So we phrased the question up there on the flip chart. Step therapy as effective as starting treatment with a high potency treatment. That was sort of our term, high potency. I don't know. And to be defined, so people would define a high-potency therapy differently. Some people might include in that category only alemtuzumab and Tysabri. Some people might want to include Gilenya and Tecfidera. But, so somebody who wanted to do that study could define it. But in any case, we thought that was the best term, because that's flexible.
So this is in sort of newly diagnosed patients. That would be the population.
But would it be
untreated?
Well, untreated,
Previously untreated and early in the disease. Yeah. There are those people who have never been on treatment and are doing really well.
Yeah, well,
they
probably shouldn't.
Right, exactly. So I would say.
Previously untreated.
untreated patients at in some early stages.
Active
patients.
Active patients.
Active patients. That's a good one.
Active, I think, fine.
Are there considerations you would add to this question?
Definition of high potency.
Yeah, that was. I mean, is step therapy usually and is sort of always with an interferon?
So if you're talking about the strategy of physicians, that's one question. If you're talking about the insurance driver, that's a slightly different question.
Hey, wouldn't you agree this is strictly an insurance driver more than a physician-driven? I mean, physician...
No, I wouldn't completely agree. I mean, because, I mean, one could still ask the question, should you take all comers and treat them up front, unless there's a specific contraindication, treat them all up front with Tysabri, presuming they were antibody negative, or alemtuzumab up front, or down the road, coming soon to a MS center near you, probably ocrelizumab, or should you give them an oral agent, you know, or an injectable, and then wait till they... So I don't think it's all... Because there are many patients who can go on an oral as first line. So the step doesn't always have to be from an injectable.
Maybe it's more a question of, rather than step therapy has an insurance connotation, maybe it's treatment escalation versus upfront high potency.
Yeah, that might
more,
be...
Yeah. It's more of a treatment escalation.
Yeah. Treatment escalation.
So that slow...
I think length of study would be a consideration, you know, because you'd really want to have enough exposure to understand if there's some long-term benefit. I think, like, one consideration that might be complicated is the length of the study, just because really the hypothesis is maybe by starting with a high-potency treatment, you're having some delayed progression in the long term or some longer term benefit.
I think treat aggressively early, longer term, treat hard
type of.
And we've previously suggested, you know, it's about 10 years or more to perceive differences in disability progression and outcomes. Is that would you say that?
I would say
particularly here, except that they've already transitioned from one drug to another drug.
Yeah, it takes time just to do that. Most people, doctors don't change for 6 months or longer. So you have that aspect. And then you have, if you look at purely at the relapse rates from the, you know, high potency studies, they're like 0.1 or 0.2, which means you're talking a relapse every 5 to 10 years. And so now you're, you know, these studies are big, long. You just need to give them time to play out. And not to mention that when you do this in an unblinded fashion, people will report what they
think they should report.
Because they know they're on high potency. They go,
I'm good to go.
I think in a study like this, of course MRI endpoints will be important, but I think also cognitive endpoints will be very important in a study like this.
So your point is patients. Awareness of assignment may influence.
Well, unless there's a mechanism in place to blind the examination and the analysis, or there are things like, you know, MRI factors.
You can never blind them from what they're getting.
You can blind the exam of what you're
testing.
What you're testing. Yes, that's
good. That would be good.
Yeah, just one thought. We are obviously focused on effectiveness. Should we be thinking about the whole risk benefit? So the side effect tolerability as well as part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if it sounds like we're going to present this to the group. I just wonder about high potency. Maybe we should think about a way, to remove the quotes.
Second line?
I don't like second line because that's an...
I mean, potency has more to do with the actual
efficacy,
dose, how much action you get.
I want high efficacy language because you would have to sort of give it.
Well, if I had the answer, I'm sure I would suggest it. I think what physicians are saying here is that there's appears to be a potential for more effect on disability rather than on relapses, and that there is the risks are more serious.
So is the can you discriminate them by injectables, self-injectables versus orals and intravenous? Is that
I would either say high potency or high efficacy, maybe.
I would use efficacy, maybe. And it's not necessarily disability, because people perceive these higher efficacies on the basis of
that's
how they were studying.
Or might you call these are treatments that have demonstrated larger effect sizes than...
Well, thank you for going through the exercise. I guess there's no obvious alternative.
Well, I mean, there's the three that have labeling at higher efficacy, three drugs. And I mean, if it's the U.S.-based study, there are three that have labeling that has comparative data that says they're higher than golimumab. Actually, Tefebri doesn't have that. It has the combo study, which suggests that. So, I mean, I guess if you use high efficacy, that would link it to a certain category of drugs. Tefebri again will be in the eye of the beholder when the proposal comes in.
Right.
And, you know, but so the higher efficacy.
Can we go back to question 1A? See if we have the frames of the question. Yeah, I can't see that.
I'll come up.
Maybe
you can put it
on
the
slide. Just draw it up the... Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Make a bump like on the question. Would we want to just, instead of using in terms of, and just say on disease progression and disability?
And could we say, to kind of like encompass everything people talked about, it would be disease activity, disease progression, and symptoms?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Because then it would kind of cover everything.
Quality
people.
Of life.
Yeah, I thought we were
yeah.
going to get away from the progression disability as you said.
Yeah. So maybe disease on... Sorry, we're helping your wordsmith. That's always bad. Disease activity. I mean, there would be some progression there, right? Because there
disease
activity, progression, symptoms, and quality of life, maybe. And then people can fix it after.
You're not dealing with
disability. Once you get disability, it becomes how you measure disability.
Yeah, and that would take out disability.
Yeah, it would become a relative term that's more or less encompassed in the rest of what we could have.
Yeah,
I think so.
That's how I think.
Yeah, that is a feasible study. If you take one of the four categories, not all four,
yeah.
Probably.
Well, what's the definition of progression?
Yeah.
Again,
we talked about progression and get away from EDSS. That's this
look at other things.
Or the patient determined disease status.
Yeah,
that's kind of
true.
Right. Yeah, maybe?
That's true. It doesn't have to be EDSS.
Doesn't have to be.
And I think there were comments in there.
We heard that the other day. Yeah. They're frequently. We need two slides.
Or fewer considerations.
That's right.
Thank you.
do you want to cut it in when you're ready to move your code? Break your list.
Yeah. I got it. Do what? Are we comfortable with question one? Do you want to look at question two?
Sure. Okay.
Question three.
Could this be read as, is it three arms? So continuing the same therapy, switching to a new medication, or a similar medication with a different dosage and administration. So it's just maybe
what if you put
same versus new?
I was going to say continuing the same therapy versus changing therapies or new therapy, and then you can have a parenthetical where you can put whatever you want to
I would leave that stuff about increasing the dose out because it applies to so few patients. Current strategy based on a Delphi process census analysis that the physicians don't increase the dose of interferon. They are not doing well on interferon. They go up elsewhere. So I would just leave that.
That's old.
When we only had interferons and Copaxone.
So continue the same therapy versus changing therapy. Either to a new medication or just changing therapy.
I mean, when they plan the study, they'll have to consider.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Remove the dose, different dosages?
Yes.
Yeah.
That works.
That's the reality of the
health. Yeah.
So this is there's step therapy on a different population?
Step therapy on a different population.
Oh, this is... People are already on treatment.
This is already on treatment, and they experience something. What do you do?
Yeah, some worsening as opposed to someone who presents hitting them hard early.
Yeah.
We need to define disease activity.
We don't need to, but whoever
needs to. Instagram.
Okay.
It's a good question.
And the same question as before, the comment, whether does it need to be in parentheses and quotes?
I don't know. I'm asking.
I think you're right.
Well, we have our first bullet. We need to define what disease activity is. Any other considerations?
Just one thing about I brought up before about NIDA. Again, that includes EDSS. Real true definition of need is EDSS. So I would, I'm not sure that that's the right outcome as opposed to something else that looks for freedom from disease activity but doesn't have EDSS. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So again, it could be a different disability.
Yeah, it could be.
But need itself has
a definition. Yeah, I mean, here, all the NIDA data that we have now is retrospectively collected data on in studies where EDSS was rigorously.
It is the measure used in the NIDA calculation.
Yeah.
So
but if you're starting up front, you can define the parameter.
So in the third bullet, no evidence of disease activity is a key outcome for MS patients, but EDSS component is problematic. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
So if they just took out the NIDA in parentheses?
I think if you took out the NIDA in parentheses and then put that second half of the sentence you just said, I think that's perfect.
Okay.
Because it's the need of that really.
Okay, it's just a definition.
Layla 2S is
an EDSS.
Yes.
Got it.
Previous of EDSS.
That's
short form.
The numbers 1 and 0 for 4.
That's right.
Yeah, NDA is May.
Any other considerations you want to share with a larger group?
These are pretty epic already. So.
I would like to add also a few questions.
Well, then let's look at 3 quickly and add 4 if you, this is the one about a step therapy.
By the way, high potency should change to whatever term we're using.
High efficacy.
Under consideration.
Under consideration.
consideration, but, I mean...
Blinding
yeah,
of
right?
assessment?
Blinding of assessment.
Oh, sorry.
Was there something about the
story?
Like,
I didn't catch all of the earlier. I think that's what the
dummy.
Whole point of it is. Which
okay.
Because that's how we're trying to describe the previously untreated active patients who are early in your MS course. I'm not sure how you can capture it well. You have the better terminology.
Are we going to use just the term newly diagnosed? Or did we say we did that?
We were, but
I've heard the term early active used. I've heard that term used on occasion. So in early active previously untreated patients.
In early active previously untreated patients.
I've seen that used.
So higher
it's a broader time frame than newly diagnosed,
early
but
active.
Not 3 years new.
I mean,
exactly.
Like,
after the active.
First
previously untreated.
Most studies allow for the first 5 to 10 years after real diagnosis.
Before treatment?
Before entry into the clinical trials. Most of the clinical trials now, they have boundaries of 5 to 10 years.
Sorry. Okay. Do you want to suggest the fourth question related to smoking? There was also the candidate of MRI, which I'm not sure we had a question behind that.
I think the question probably fits maybe over in the care section. But really, like, what is the comparative benefit of different monitoring practices? That's essentially what I even...
The problem with smoking is, I mean, you can ask the question, do smokers have a worse outcome on a particular drug or on any drugs than do non-smokers? That doesn't answer the question of whether if they weren't smoking, they would be doing better.
Well, what the question means is active smoking cessation effort versus none.
That would be the intervention.
That's the intervention.
That's
an important question.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do active smoking cessation efforts
have materially improved
outcomes?
Yeah.
As compared to none, I guess.
Supposed to, or generic. For example, by analogy, there was a protocol-driven stress management program that had a phase 2 trial on MRI, and was a very positive trial. And as soon as the patient finished the intervention, their disease activity resumed. But you know, so there, but there is a paradigm for designing that. Kind of
trial
there.
And that might be one that goes to the
because there are quite a few of them, but I've seen more with the interventions from the providers. You can only randomize by your intervention.
Well, sometimes, you know, there's many ways you can approach smoking cessation. You can say, you know, there's some smoking cessation effort, you know, a quick line, use of nicotine replacement therapy, et cetera, et cetera. Has a different effect upon outcomes relative to no intervention or you know, comparative effectiveness of smoking cessation interventions to modify the disease course or something like that. We can play with the words because we now have, I think, about a period of half an hour that before we reconvene as a group. So I invite anyone who wants to stay here and help us massage these terminologies, and we may be able to do it more
passively than I'm trying to do it right now. You're welcome to stay, but you're also very welcome to take a break and check email or whatever you might need to do before we gather again as a group.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
all.
Thank
you,
everyone. Thank you very much.
All right.
And maybe I'll step up, or we can do it here as a group. We can respond to question four to your liking.
There must be a lot of precedent.
Could you?
Oh, of course. The whole. Mm-hmm.
With respect to infrastructure and pilot projects and so forth.
is I'm going to put together kind of a steering committee to get people and staff and the industry
in
there,
right?
With that.
Yeah.
And we're going to be meeting again
if
in
I would be
6 to 9 months.
Yeah,
so,
cool.
So,
I mean, if I'm not the right person, Charlie would be a great person.
Charlie, he must not have been able to come because
he would be all over it.
Yeah.
He certainly
would.
For being
new
to
industry. I'm almost a sweetheart. I mean,
What is the comparative effectiveness of stopping therapy versus continuing therapy?
What is the having therapy.
After a period of prolonged
stability.
Compared to continuing.
I'm going to put this on a separate slide. This isn't really for a good question.
You can say this was one that we raised as an issue, but we didn't have time to do that.
Right.
And we weren't sure if another group took it.
When do we have to give this to?
I think just once it's by 10 over 3.
Okay.
All right, so we're good?
We're good, thank you.
Thank you very much for all the slide work.
All right. Question one. Good. I split question one and two because it was two the considerations flow into the second.
Okay.
Not busy slide.
Well, it'll run off depending on your slide master.
Oh. Okay, so then are you saying formatting maybe isn't as...
No, I think it's fine.
Okay.
As long as it fits on the slide, you can tell.
Down and stuff.
Okay. But I'm happy to help you just massage this.
Thanks. Did we decide on instead of using step therapy, we're just going to use treatment escalation? So is treatment escalation as effective as starting treatment with higher efficacy treatments?
You could say, what's the comparative effectiveness of stopping versus continuing therapy? After a period of prolonged.
Okay.
So, and you could want to put considerations, say maybe perhaps that's under cross-cutting or something.
Okay.
cutting beans?
Yeah, the question mark was, you know.
Cross-cutting beans?
Cross-cutting group.
Group. Okay.
Question mark.
Okay. Okay, good.
Great job of keeping on top of what
people
do.
No problem.
I saw you sort of looking. I figured, no, she's good. She's good.
I wanted to make sure I'm capturing appropriately. Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're just going to present, I guess, all four discussions to the larger stakeholder group.
Yeah, and that'll be Dr. Miller's. Okay, so that's that.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Is he supposed to be like a leader?
Well, he clearly has very extensive contacts.
I think, yeah.
But he didn't know for Corey, and he's, Oh, someone looked up the mouse here.
Oh, that was John Marler.
Thank you. Bring the 10 cards in case they're at the table and they need to be identified. Oh, thank you both. They raised important questions.
This is a very tough disease.
Yeah.
And it's not a common
disease. You know, the other folks didn't really get a chance to talk as much.
Yeah.
Well, I think we tried, and I think we certainly did better when you came than we had before, because it was just mostly one, maybe two people.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, you know.
You did a good job, though. I think you were regulating as you needed.
Yeah.
I think you did a good job.
It's a more polite way of saying, shut the...
Yeah. I got your hint.